I guess you could call my guest today a champion for fun. In particular, introducing fun into the workplace. Not just for fun's sake, but because it's a good way to learn and it's a good way to engage. So that's Mike. Before I get into the questions, let's just give a little bit about our scenarios, because I can see we're talking over Zoom at the moment. I can see you waving at neighbours walking past. You're likely to hear whirring laptops. I've got my neighbour's kids bouncing on the trampoline outside. Mike is relocated his office into his garage out in, is it Moyles Court School you're next door to, kind of out somewhere in... Is that Hampshire or are you in Dorset still?
Yeah, New Forest, a mile maybe above Ringwood. Moyles Court School is where my daughter goes, so we've moved here. And yeah, my broadband finally gave in the ghost this morning, so I'm currently on the school broadband, operating from an open garage door, so I get the signal. And my wife and daughter have literally just found me, so they've come downstairs from their online schooling and danced around laughing at me.
I saw you were including your daughter in a post on LinkedIn the other day, and she looks like she's great at doing some flossing in terms of dancing. You got a bit of flossing, kind of introducing her into your LinkedIn seminars that you were giving, which was a nice touch, I thought.
Yeah, so she's obviously doing homeschooling at the moment, and lots of that my wife is fantastic at. So for me to add some kind of contribution, we've been making videos together, putting them on LinkedIn, and I guess doing things slightly differently. So yeah, she's been playing the flute on some. We've got one coming up where she smashes the Rubik's Cube in under a couple of minutes, and all sorts of craziness.
Well, I've got to declare an interest, actually, for Moyles Court School, because I came out of acting retirement after about 20 years to go and get involved in a film that was being made by a local production company called Treehouse. And they specialized in short form movies. And they were making this horror movie for a YouTube channel called Crypt TV. And they had a series called Shelley, and they were commissioned to do a repeat of that. And so Shelley season two, I ended up being a head teacher based in Moyles Court School. Obviously, it wasn't the school, and it was really quite gruesome and not recommended for children, but really good fun. And it's a really lovely part of the world. So I've actually been up there, and that was, it's just a really, I can imagine where you are, and it's a lovely place to be. And I'm really looking forward to maybe hearing some of the birdsong coming in while we're talking too.
Yeah, so I've seen that video and seen you get gruesomely murdered at the end, if that's not too much of a spoiler. So yeah,
I think it's my just rewards. So let's come back to what we're going to talk about a bit more, Mike. So Mike, you've worked in the games industry for over 22 years, and I suppose rather than me catalogue your achievements, it might be better to let you give us the story. So you started out in games as a founding partner of 4T2 in, what was it, 1998? What was the idea behind that? And because it felt you hadn't been out of university for that long, really, before you set up your own company.
No. So I worked for a company called Unicorn Training for a year. They asked me to design their website, which I did with the help of a very intelligent friend called Rob Fell. And I suddenly found this online thing was pretty awesome. We were having to read books to figure out how to do it at the time because it was a fairly new thing. And asked Unicorn Training, look, we should set up online division and do online e-learning. And they kind of looked at me like I was crazy, but were awesome. So they gave me my computer, 3 months' wages, and a couple of clients to go and set up a internet company. So me and Rob, Rob's was one of Red Web or Key Design, I think they were called at the time, first web people, went and set up a company and created websites.
And how long did you do the websites for before you started getting attracted to the games, going, come over here, come over, come and do us?
So we noticed pitching for websites was getting massively competitive in about the year 2000. We were going up against specialist agencies. So we would pitch for Bath Travel's website, and we pitched against a person who just does travel agency websites. And it was like, might not win this one. And at the same time, my brother actually was doing a break at Hubba Bubba, his year out kind of thing. And they asked, can we do some, have a look at their website? So out of nowhere, Rob turns his computer around one day and goes, Mike, I've made a game. And it's like, a what? And he had used a Flash to make a game, or whatever it was called at the time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we built this thing that we didn't know the internet could do. And subsequently thought, well, if we can get away with doing Flash games as opposed to like normal websites, surely this is a cool thing. So we went for it. And yeah, I'm not quite sure how we pulled that one off, but we turned having fun into a fantastic job with fantastic clients.
Did you always have that sense of adventure behind the work that you started out doing? Were you always looking to try and introduce a bit of a fun element into it and not be too serious about it all?
Didn't necessarily realize that at the time, but certainly I've grown to appreciate the fact that if we can entertain people, things work better, things are much more effective. So our saying at 42, our slogan at 42 evolved into fun first, message second. So whatever we were using fun to convey, make sure it was fun from the outset, and once they're engaged and people are hooked, then deliver your message. And I've just taken that with me for the rest of my life, basically, because it works. Once you engage people, you can deliver your message. If you try and deliver your message before people are engaged, they'll not listen.
Okay, well, I want to come into that and dive into that in a bit more detail. But before we get there, I guess, how did you... So you were very much a client-focused agency to begin with. Were you doing any of your own products? Did you start developing your own games, or were you really looking about working for clients and developing games for them?
So we started off doing advert games. So we'd ring up a company and say, I think we can convey your message very well with a game. And lo and behold, we started to get some people to believe us. So there was a brand called Funky Friends, who were a brand license that you could get the images and put them on pencil cases and Christmas cards and things like that. And we did a dressing up game for the Funky Friends, so you could put on their outfits and all the kids were having great fun with it. And we suddenly realized that the website traffic wasn't the same as the number of people playing the game. And what was happening were people were stealing the game, as we initially called it, and placing it on their websites, putting banners around it, and monetizing this other company's content, which initially our clients called bandwidth theft and were distraught about it, until they realized all of a sudden their brand was being seen all around the world by a tremendous number of people, and they were paying nothing for it other than that bandwidth. So we converted that into online advert gaming, and lo and behold, website after website started forming that cottoned onto this. So Newgrounds, Kongregate, there's Miniclip, and they did exactly that. They put games on websites to make the web entertaining.
So how did you go about finding clients in those early days, and what sort of clients did you end up getting?
So one of the first was a car racing league, because we'd done a game for Vauxhall. That was for their VXR car range, and we put that on their website, and it just went off, and it just went viral. The people were taking this car game and putting it all over the place, which led to another car game for exchange in Mart and a said digital racing league. Then from there, we did something for the BBC, for probably children's BBC. And we started working with them a lot, putting games on their websites, which led to Toonatic, which was ITV Saturday, Sunday TV show. 7:30 to 9:30 with Jamie and Anna presenting cartoons in an attic. And the bit GMTV owned was the bit between the cartoons. So we had an amazing few years, or 6 years, I think, working with them. We would basically make their TV show and their website symbiotic. So I think it got called 360 marketing in the end, that across all the media it was wrapping around. And we were doing that way before even the BBC were. So It was, we would meet up, we would have the marketing people, the production team, the actors, everyone in a room once a month, or this is how we got it refined. And we'd think, right, what can we do? What's coming up? So Wimbledon was coming up. So we thought, okay, let's make a tennis game. How do we make a tennis game for children? Well, let's do a game where you hit the ball around the pole, but have custard pies on it. So the production team would think about how to turn that into a TV show. The salespeople would go and talk to Robinson's Drinks. We would make the game. And therefore, in a month's time, everything flowed into one, which was just amazing. I can remember the first episode when they launched their website, because their website was a game. And they had Jamie, the actor, literally build the website out of cardboard boxes and press a button at the end to launch the website, which, of course, put a massive peak drive of traffic to it, so it immediately broke. But ignoring that, it was sensational. And then the next week, over time, we got it all working, and we've got out these bugs and kinks and figured out how to do it. So from there, BBC Worldwide, Disney, we did Phineas and Ferb Pinball, that was cool, we did Hanaroki, and then came the big break, did a talk at a brand licensing show. I was doing talks for Business Link at the time, so I'd got this little routine down where I made people race around the audience on chairs, on wheelie chairs, and I had silly string and water pistols all around the back row, so by the time they got back to the front on their little guest, on their little race, they were fully, they looked like trifles, basically.
So hold on, let's go back onto this one. So you're in like a big presentation theatre somewhere, and you're getting people to go onto chairs with wheels on, and what, are they racing around, and then you've got other people spraying them with silly spray and stuff like that?
That's exactly right. So I'd be at the front on the stage, and I'd try and say, look, I can make anything fun, and if I make something fun, you'll be more engaged and you'll listen to me. So I'm going to make office chairs fun, and everyone looks at you like you're crazy. So then you pull two wheelie chairs out and you put them in front of the audience. You get two volunteers and you say, right, who's going to go for it? And then they race around the audience on the wheelie chairs. Luckily, health and safety wasn't quite so big a thing back there. And on the people on the back row, you've planted a load of weapons, basically. So water pistols, party poppers, all that kind of stuff. So by the time they get to the front, it's just comedy gold. So everyone's laughing, everyone's, and you say, you see what I mean? Now these chairs, you want to talk about them. And one of those people that I put on that chair, because I put myself in the position to be lucky, was the head of Lego's licensing, who was there to explore licensing. Week later, we're over, we get a phone call from Lego. Then we go and see them, and we worked with Lego for the next 12 years. It was simple as that. They became our number one client, and I've just had the most amazing time with them ever.
Well, I'd like to dive into that in a moment. Before we do, I'm just really intrigued by the whole of that story, is that you've talked about Vauxhall Exchange and Mart, BBC, Disney. You've got some really big clients, but you're presumably a fairly young company still. And I just wondered that in order to get that level of power and success in what you're doing, is there an element that you are doing something which is untried, untested, it's new? The whole of the game's introduction was at a fairly early stage in those days, so there were fewer people around, there was less competition, or was it more the fact that your whole approach to this enabled you to put you in front of those sort of people, or was it a combination of both maybe?
Yeah, well, the answer is a combination. So confidence, saying yes, and then figuring out how the heck to actually do it played a large part in where we went for. Being brave, being very ambitious, and trying new things, because that's the only way to see if it sticks. And most of the things we tried work fantastically. And if you've got clients and they know they're going in something that may not work in the way they expect it to, and they mitigate those risks, that's always fantastic. And then small, really good team, massively dedicated people. I've worked with some of the best, cleverest people I can ever hope to work with. They're fantastic. So having a great team that believe in your vision, enjoy what they're doing, and go, oh my Lord, look, it's Saturday morning and our games are on ITV, they're on Channel 4 and they're on BBC all at the same time, was just amazing.
So, and that's all about, I guess, well, like you say, that having the confidence to do that. It seems to me that if you're setting up or you're starting games in 2000, that the gaming wasn't a mature market, and just that there may be a lesson in there somewhere that if you can try and identify a new niche as it's developing, that's going to give you a head start over, let's say, like you rightly recognized before as a web agency. Suddenly there's a lot of competition, and that competition is becoming increasingly specialized, and it's harder and harder to get good work, big clients. Whereas if you come in and identify something and, hey, this is new, not many people are doing this yet, it's going to definitely take off, or you invest your belief behind that, then that's going to give you a much better chance of getting up in front of the big boys and leading up to big contracts like Lego.
Yeah, so I guess as a small company, our challenge would always have been marketing. How do we get in front of these big companies and make them listen to us? So what we did was put me on a stage to give talks. Then you talk to, 300 people at once. Maybe one or two people in that crowd really like what you're saying. They come up to you. They're the easiest people to convert in clients ever because they're totally on board to start with. And then the other 298, you don't waste your time talking to, which is amazing. So we did lots and lots of that. And then the fact the games we made were brilliant fun to play. And you could just send a game to someone and say, this is what we've done. And expand on that about how we might take it and use it with their brand was just super powerful. So awesome, great fun product and a way to cut through the noise. Those are the two things that really helped us, I think.
Did you have any criteria by which you chose where you would go and present? Or actually, did you feel that anybody could have a game? So it doesn't really matter where you go. As long as there are people in there, the chances are one or two people will come up to you at the end.
Absolutely. It's just shouting your opinion into as many people as you possibly can get. Make that engaging. And away we went. So Andy Walker, listening to your podcast, and he went on the first about going global and you should concentrate on your local market first and then refine that and then go bigger. I might as well go there. So I think the absolute opposite. I think what you should do is launch your product to as many people as humanly possible, e.g. go global as quickly as possible. Find out who likes it and then see if you can figure out what the same thing is between all those different companies that have liked it. Because that will be what you do really well, and that will be the answer. Whereas if you're just focusing on one market, you might miss something entirely. So with digital products, go global as fast as you can, figure out who likes it, and then figure out what the thing they're all liking is. And the way I've just demonstrated that, the way I've just picked a fight, for want of a better word, on something I'm passionate about, and I've told lots of people, e.g. a podcast about this, I've voiced my opinion. Doesn't matter if I'm right or if I'm wrong. Some people will believe me because that's my opinion, and that's why they'll want to work with me, and the others will want to work with Andy. So that's how I did my talks. I went up, I picked someone I was passionate about, and I would deliberately make it so lots of the audience wouldn't agree with me.
So that's interesting. So it's not necessarily a question about being right or wrong. It's just a question about being true to the way that you see it, and that by the same token, you're not going to please all the people all of the time. So what you want to do is to try and identify people who are going to be on a similar wavelength that you are. So if you are just true to your beliefs, the chances are you're going to pick up and connect with those people. And because there are so many people in the world, the chances are someone else is going to agree with you.
100%. That's exactly right. So that's the way we did all our talks, and also quite a lot of games work like that. So you find your audience there and you niche into that. So it just works.
Did you ever have any worries about how you were going to service and deliver, that if you go global and go big quickly, have you got a danger of overstretching yourself?
Well, scaling is always one of the most challenging things to do. However, when you're working with big brands, they've got the route to market already. They've got the route to the audience, so that's their problem. What you're doing is delivering a digital asset for them to put across their different media, be it the cinema, the radio, toys, whatever that might be. So, yeah, going back to the topic of what you talk about, what is the truth? What is the right answer? It's so many times you find out it's just A or B. There isn't actually a concrete, yeah, that's right and that's wrong. So operate in the gray and go for it.
So when you were going, well, when you're doing this and you're looking to connect people, so partly it's about the things that you talk about, but also with the example with the guy from Lego, then that's just about doing something fun. So did you have a number of other approaches up your sleeve about how you connect and engage people in that way if you were in presentation?
We knew who we wanted to work for because we were brand addicts, basically, and we worked for the people who had the best toys and might like our message. So Coca-Cola, let's face it, who wouldn't want to pick up Coca-Cola as a client? So we flyed their car park. Because why wouldn't you? If you want to get their attention and everyone's knocking on the front door, well, all the cars are parked in the back. So we put flyers under all their things looking for the person who wanted to work with us. And lo and behold, that one worked. We've done all sorts of crazy little stunts. You just got to figure out what makes you stand out and what makes you special.
Well, I remember a presentation I've seen you at before. I think you got everyone to make a paper plane and throw it at the screen, and there was a box on the screen, and if anybody hit it, they got a prize, or the first person to hit it, things like that. Just that's just like a bum settler almost, isn't it? Just kind of getting people to like you quickly before you start talking about what you want to talk about.
I would say that engaging and entertaining people, look, fun first, message second. So you have to figure out a way to engage your audience first, and then you can go do a little bit of message. But I would say when I do a talk, 80% of my attention goes on to how I'm going to entertain people, and 20% of it goes on one tiny thing that I want them to remember.
How far do you think you can take that? Do you ever feel like you pushed that envelope as far as it could go and maybe almost cross the line?
No, because every time I've tried to cross that line, I thought, wow, I got away with that. And then let's have a go at this. Surely I'm not going to get away with this. And lo and behold. So, yes, there will be one day where I cross that line, obviously. And what damage can it do? You just got to assess that. But I'd say go for it and you might surprise yourself. And, yeah, lots of people think I'm completely bonkers and start raving mad. I totally get that. I just say that I've had fun. When I look back on my life, God, my, I've had some fun.
Well, it's interesting. I suppose quite often when you think about people at work, that there is a tendency that when it comes to a work situation, you feel like you need to be serious because work is serious business and that's what it's all about. And do you consciously try to buck that, or is that just inherently who you are? Or are you just somebody who's never been very good about taking authority and you want to do it your own way?
Yeah, all of those things. So I can remember going to a games conference when we launched one of our own IP games, and it was Cows versus Sheep. And we went to that conference, and there's lots of clever people in the games industry with amazing games, but it was an industry event. We had our people, including myself, dressed up as cows. And we're the only ones actually bringing fun into a games conference. And it was like everyone wanted to talk to us. And we reminded them what the games industry is actually about. And yeah, you can, if you make people smile, you're on a winner. And lots of people will want to ignore you and just say, yeah, you're not for me. But they're not going to work for you anyway. They're the people who you're just simply wasting your time talking to. So find the ones that like you.
So if you were going to be advising somebody to be a bit more adventurous, what do you think are the things that they should look at? Is it about, I suppose, if they're looking to connect with somebody in a business, is it about trying to identify with the person who is in that position of authority, or who might want to commission them, and try and get past the idea of the business and this is what the business is like? But actually, people are just people, and that person who you're trying to talk to is going to be different when you would meet them in the pub or in a cafe or somewhere else. So you're trying to connect with that side of the person. And just because they're in work doesn't mean they have to be dull.
No, exactly. Because they want to be fun as well. Why wouldn't they? So give it a go, find out what happens, try and be that little bit more courageous. It doesn't matter what your starting point is, just 5% more courageous than you were on the last thing and see where it takes you. So it doesn't matter what your starting point is, just try and be that little bit more brave and see what happens.
So let's come back to Lego for a second. So you said you won that first contract, and then that has just became bigger and bigger and bigger and the bigger part of your business. So how did you go from the first step in terms of developing that and getting more and more interest? Have you spread out into other divisions across the company, or have you been working with the same people all the time?
So we got very lucky that the first person I worked with, whose name was Brent, really, really wanted to be sort of take over Lego games kind of thing, was super ambitious and was a genuinely awesome person and knew how to promote both himself and the titles and things he did internally, which I didn't realize the importance of at first, but a huge lesson I got taught that internal promotion and internal awareness is massive, huge key for working with big brands to get more projects and get more people interested. So I still don't know how much of this story is true, but here we go. In my memory, what happened was he launched his game. It was for a small brand called Aqua Raiders, and it worked very well. It was a lovely game, but to get the attention of the people at Lego, he went up to the canteen and he did Fish Finger Friday. So he got permission off the restaurant, the canteen at Lego, to give people a free fish finger. They wanted it. So he was standing at the end of the queue. Everyone wants a fish finger, clearly, because why wouldn't you? And he goes, if you play my game and things and go and have a look at it, you can have a free fish finger. So all of Lego, therefore, found out about the fish fingers and the game. And from that, we moved on to Lego City, and I'm an amazing lady next called Pia, and Pia was just would have bled Lego. She just understood everything about the brand and the messaging, and just was the most awesome, nice person ever. And with her help, we figured out how to do an awesome game for Lego City that was just so perfectly Lego. Then we did Barnacle, then we did, we just went through all the brands basically, and it was an amazing time.
So that led for a number of years, and then 42 converts into Amuso, or is it a new company, or kind of tell me a little bit about that transition.
So we launched our first mobile games, and well, we talked to Lego, and I can always remember the conversation where I'm sat down one level under top board, and I had the head of their websites, the head of online, the head of this, that, and the other, and we said we want to do our next Lego game not on your website, we want to make it a mobile app. And that was just quite a new thing. There's no one in the chair for mobile in that boardroom, so it's like telling a load of people we don't want to use what you've got, but we've always been disruptive and trying to go that way. So they listened, they trusted us because we'd won lots of awards, and they gave us a small brand to do it with. And overnight, we got 400% more traffic to the game, 300% better retention, and never looked back. Millions turned into billions.
In terms of users, not dollars.
Yes, in terms of users, it was just the value they were getting from their games then, their marketing games, just went astronomical. And we got a license from Lego to do a game that was responsibly monetized. Because our theory was, if you do this in a responsible way, so small payments, not regular, one-off purchases under £5, we might get the people who like the marketing games to want more and therefore buy a little thing inside of them. So we went for it. We took a license from Lego and we built a responsibly monetized game, the theory being maybe we can make their marketing self-funding. And off we went. So that's when we rebranded to Amuso, because no one could say 42. So I'd had probably 12 years maybe at that stage in my life saying, no, number four, letter T, number two. No, number four. And I'd had enough, so had all the rest of our team. So we rebranded to go B2C, because we thought Amuso might be easier to say and spell than 42. Don't know that that's true, but it worked. We got a nice new brand out of it, and it signified a movement for us to go full mobile. That was it. No more flash games. Amuzo is mobile only. Let's go for it.
And did you take a share in the returns that you got through the mobile games? Did you start to take your on your own risk? Were you then becoming a product development company working under license, or were you still being paid by LEGO as a client agency relationship?
Both. So for some games, we got paid by LEGO, and for others, we took licenses and shared in the investment and the reward.
Okay. And did you find that that was different? Did that start putting different pressures on the business in terms of if you're working with a different business model, does that make a change? Did you feel that?
I can't think of a business model. We haven't tried, to be perfectly honest. as times change, you've got to change with them. So, yeah, we've gone through affiliate deals, we've gone through licensing, we've gone through in-app purchases, we've gone, you name it, we've tried it at some point. And yes, I mean, Muzo, even now, they're making some of the most amazing games, certainly better than we ever did before because they're a much bigger team and things. And they're trying to go only games they produce internally, which is extraordinarily hard because you've got front invest into them. So to get to that point, we had to do it bit by bit. So slowly be able to invest more into the games over time to give you the opportunity to fully invest.
And so you're not connected with Amuzo. You've now moved on from Amuzo.
So we got the people who originally hired me, Unicorn Training. They liked what we were doing and bought into Amuzo. Because they wanted to do learning games. And I've taken the learning games side of it, sold my shares in the game side of it, and I'm now doing learning games. And that company's been bought by the company that bought Unicorn. So all of a sudden I find myself working for a big business for the first ever time. I've worked for them, being hired by them, but I've never had a boss before. It's a very strange experience.
Well, let's come on into that kind of serious gaming side of things in a second. But let me just ask, just as a matter of interest, how was it to step away from something that you've invested years and years, you know, almost 20 years in terms of the amount of time that you've built up with 42 and then with Amuzo, that you must have a lot of personal investment in all of that. How did it feel to step away from that? And presumably, so you sold your shares into that and just made a clean break to move on. What was that like?
Scary, uncomfortable, miss everyone there. They're such great people. Miss working on those projects. But I'd been there and I'd done it and I wanted to try something different as well. And just like I had previously, when we thought flash games, when we thought mobile, when we thought now is the time where I believe if we jump to productize serious games, we'll make it's the right thing to do. It's the right time to make this choice. And the people at Amuzo, trying to convince a group of people who've made games and ninjas and Star Wars characters and things like that to make serious games, we struggled with it terribly. And it's a different mindset. Yeah, it's nowhere near as exciting, but it's still really good what we're doing. And fingers crossed, by being productized, now we can really properly do something I've never done before.
Yeah, that was interesting. I was interested about how the timing is constituted in terms of when you say it's the right time to do this. But actually, that's been motivated more, not so much that you've fallen out of love with what you did before, but you've just seen a new opportunity and that you want to try and go for that opportunity and give yourself a new challenge as well.
Exactly. That's a very good way of describing it. This is a proper challenge. No one's really done serious productized games before particularly well, I don't feel. And if we can smash that out of the park, we're on a real winner. And it feels good to be creating games that have a good use as well, because what we're doing is teaching people skills that will benefit their careers and their life, which is a very different from selling invisible swords that don't exist and things like that. So yeah, it's slightly different.
What is it that constitutes a serious productized game or gaming. What does that actually mean?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The word serious is a complete misleader. So we never call them serious games. We just call them games, basically, or learning games.
Do people call it gamification as well? Is that part of that?
Yes. That a separate thing? No, gamification is used kind of lots of times, so gamifying learning. But gamification is taking something that isn't a game and adding game elements to it. Whereas we make games, because why do it by halves? We make a quiz game with avatars that is super engaging and makes you smile when you play it. And because you're engaged, you'll play it more, and therefore you'll take the questions again and again, and you'll learn stuff. It puts into your deep memory. We had an Italian lady play over the weekend who played it 250 times. She loved it. This is one minute quiz, 250 times over a weekend, because she just wanted to figure out how it was helping her learn something. So she was going from scientific point of view, because she was working for a pharmacy kind of thing. And it's just awesome watching people figure out how it's affecting their memory and how they're putting it into their long-term memory. So another person figured out, after drawing a little map of all the questions, that if she looked at the last question, sorry, the last word in the question, the last word, the answer, because you're getting these questions again and again, her right eye processed data faster than her left eye, so she could score much more. It was like, it's just a pleasure to work and find these new things out.
That's incredible. So how did she discover that?
Because she's a super analytical person and literally took our quiz apart in her head with databases and all sorts of things, trying to figure out how to build her quizzes so they just have the maximum impact, and how to play it so she could beat her colleagues. And she enjoyed every single moment of that experience. So how many times do you get people doing e-learning and willingly playing it again and again? Normally it's just boring, let's face it. So all we're doing is the same trick: engage and entertain people, then deliver your message.
So what you're doing is taking game principles, game mechanics, and putting them into a learning scenario. So everything that you're focusing on now has a learning element, whereas the games you were doing before probably were just more about fun and entertainment. That what you've got now is a serious component to it, which is trying to affect change as a result of going through this experience for the person who's having that experience. And they would learn something, but they wouldn't necessarily know they'd learned it, or would they be very aware that they'd learned something?
They're probably very aware when they suddenly got asked in front of one of their staff, what is the answer to this? And they just say the answer and they're like, how did I know that? But I would take challenge on your point that every single game is always trying to teach you things, and games are the best learning mechanism, because if you think about any game you ever play, right, the first obstacle, how do I jump it? Okay, I've mastered jumping. Right, the next thing, something's attacking me. How do I stop it, attack it? They're constantly teaching you things bit by bit in a bite-sized manner, in an engaging way. So, I don't know, halfway, 4 hours into a game, when some creature appears and you've got to defend yourself and you know exactly how to do it, it's just trial and error, getting in there, giving it a go.
Well, do you think that those skills that you learn from playing games then get applied outside and away from a screen? Or because it feels as if the stuff that you're talking about that you're doing now is directly applicable to what people are doing in their jobs, presumably,
yes.
Maybe kind of further beyond that. The distinction is by degrees rather than wholesale.
Yeah, so now, so onboarding is a really good one for the app we build now. So if you're new to a company, we'll create a really engaging quizzes that take you through the ins and outs of working for that company. Anything to do with sales, knowing your facts and figures. So when a customer's in front of you and they ask how much is a X, Y, or Z, you can just go, bang, I know this fact, especially if your products are changing a lot, because learning that all the time and keeping yourself updated is difficult. Software updates. Say you work for a big company and you're regularly releasing new features. How do you let your internal staff know about those features? Make a game of it. Has it got this in? Does it do that? Anything you can think of, you can deliver facts in an engaging way and just break it down, bite-size it up. Away you go.
I mean, in terms of that engagement, you kind of wonder how much wider you could apply it. So, I mean, not necessarily just about work, but maybe it could be applied into your marketing or something like that. But I was just wondering that in terms of those game principles, what does it come down to some specific principles that you have to follow? And can you take those on and apply them in life, just in conversation almost?
So this is kind of what all my little videos with my daughter are about. So I'm a big advocate of bite-sized content. There is a game called CSR Racer, and I think fairly famously the MD at the time of that company said, anyone who brings an idea to my door, make sure I can play it in a bus queue. Because if I can't play it in a bus queue, I'm going to play a different app. I never want to think I haven't got time to play this game, ever. So I can play it for 4 hours by doing repetitive iterative loop, but just make sure I can have a complete game in that bus queue. Totally agree with him. Utterly. It was just, when I heard that, it really rammed it home. It's just, if I can do my little bit of learning when I want to, where I want to, for a tiny amount of time, and do that frequently, and spread that over a few days, that's got to be the best way of learning things.
And in terms of the basic mechanics that you apply, so one of the things that you hear about games is it's based on task and reward, that you set people tasks and you get a reward of doing that. Whether, like you were saying before, that you get set a barrier in your level one of the game and then you overcome that and then you have that skill and that skill can be applied later on. Do you see that can be applied just in everyday, kind of away from screens, away from the phone, just in terms of how people deal with each other? I mean, it may be that actually that's the, you know, there are some underlying principles and mechanics that come into sales and some of the ways in which you've approached that selling with the examples we gave earlier on.
It's about praise and motivation. People work better if they're praised and things like that. So all mobile games do these days is set you an achievable tiny bit of challenge and then praise you and reward you for completing it. And if you could bring that into your life as much as possible, that would be fantastic. But it all comes from the fact that you used to buy a console game and say spend £50 on it. And therefore, you wanted to earn your £50 back out of that game. So you'd sit there and you'd go through hardship to get to the end. Because I've just spent £50, so I'm going to keep going at this. I don't care how annoying it is, I'm going to beat that. Whereas in a mobile game, you've no upfront investment. Therefore, all you're putting in is time. So you could stop at any point. So what we do is we just tell you how marvelous you are all the way through it and just say, well done, keep going. And if you get stuck, we actively try and help you, not make that challenge harder. And it's a nice way to operate. It's being thanked more often and being recognized for what you're doing, surely got to be a good thing.
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, especially at the moment, I think people are, while we're in lockdown, that being able to give that praise and appreciation that you have for people, even if they're in furlough or not necessarily working for you, that's a really important thing to be able to do at the moment. Do you see how that gamified thinking can be applied into dealing with staff? I mean, are there ways that you can do this if you don't have the budget to create a game all by itself? Are there small steps that people could take to start applying game theory and game thinking into the workplace?
There's absolutely lots, but the first thing would be a good thing to do is do stuff together, hit the lunch break. We used to play Mario Karts when we could actually sit around some sofas together, and they were the best moments of our day. So we'd all sit there around there, play 2v2 at Mario Karts, and have awesome lunch breaks. And just from that, it just works outwards from there. But just try. See what works with your people.
Something about a kind of a togetherness of just, actually spending time with each other, and the games are the vehicle by which you do that. But it's more in terms of spending time, being on the same wavelength and enjoying things in each other's company.
Yeah, and you've got to get everyone on board on this message as well, because personally, I'm very, very driven. So sometimes forget to thank people and say well done and and go for it. So I need other people around me who are very good at this to keep it going when I'm being rubbish at it.
Yeah. So something you've talked about, I mean, well, actually the two things are completely unrelated, but something that you've talked about in the past are the importance of failing and that if you don't fail, you're not testing your limits. Is that something that you try to apply to yourself?
Oh, 100%. You just go for it, find out what happens. And I'm past the point where I care about failing in the slightest because I know that if you're trying your hardest and as you practice and get good at this, your success rate will increase exponentially. And if you're not at the edge, if you're not pushing it as hard as you can, then someone else is going to be doing that and you're going to lose.
Have you got a good, preferably embarrassing example of when you've tried and you've fallen flat on your ass?
Oh, countless, but for some reason I don't remember those.
Okay. And you've also talked about thinking big. And I think when you think big and when you communicate big thoughts, that could be quite scary for sometimes. How do you carry people along on that journey?
Enthusiasm, belief, and just the simple fact of if you're not thinking big, why bother? I simply don't understand people who don't think, right, where's the end point that I can take this? How do I really, really go for it? Because surely everyone wants to get there. And it's overcoming your own fears of failure and pride and being embarrassed, I guess. If you can work through those things and just constantly go for it and work in an environment where you're not punished for failing and you're not punished for making silly mistakes, then why wouldn't you go for it if you've got the huge, awesome benefit? So the company I work for now, Access Group, they've given us so much freedom to go for it. It's extraordinary. I can't thank them enough. And without that ability to make an idiot out of yourself, how are you gonna get there?
So I suppose that the challenge is in if you're working with people who feel inhibited by some of that, who feel that you may be stretching yourself too far, is there a question of you just need to try and find the right people to be working with in the first place, or are there things that you've done in the past which have helped people to overcome some of their initial reservations?
No, quite a few members of my team, I'm thinking of one in particular, it's constantly, we can't do that. That's not going to happen. We'll never get that out for that date. And you need that because you need someone to be saying, no, this is, and maybe you'll mitigate the risks because of what they're saying. So being around people who spot when you're being an idiot and really going too far is hugely, hugely useful. But at the same time, we've got track record for succeeding now. And when you succeed and when you go for it, it builds your own belief. So the things that people doubted at the beginning are very, very different from the things they doubt now. But no, you have to be around a mixed group of people. So whatever you do, don't put yourself in a group that everyone thinks, yeah, you should do that, Mike, because I'd have jumped off a building a long time ago with some kind of homemade parachute with a brand on the back of it and, yeah, be splat on the pavement.
I think Steve Jobs talks about, is it the reality distortion field, or other people spoke about him having one in terms of trying to bend reality to his will, where he could see something and just pushed it and went for it and just convinced anybody he came into contact that this was possible and that there was there would be doubts and there would be the ability of, no, we can't do this. We can't make touchscreens work as effectively as you want them to be, and he would just, with his force of will, would bend reality to shape what he could see the future being and to try and get it to fit his vision. Do you ever get to that level, or do you just think for you it's all about enthusiasm and encouragement?
You have to everyone's going to tell you wrong, no matter if you're doing something new. Well, you're wrong because no one's done it before. So how are you meant to know that that's the answer? So you've got to have a skin thicker than you can ever possibly imagine and just try and put your fingers in your ears and keep going and fight through that pain barrier, because 100% you're going to get it. And hopefully you had the right idea, But lots of people will say, if everyone's telling you to do it wrong, maybe you should listen to them. Well, I totally disagree. Because if I did, I would nowhere near be working where I am today. And I just love what I do. So, yeah, I would say keep fingers in your ears. Keep going until you absolutely can't take one more step in the direction you want to go. Because if you can wake up in the morning and think, right, there is one more thing I can do to make this work, then you should be doing it.
Yeah. So what does the next couple of years look like for you?
So launch GameBrain properly. We were just launching it before everything got locked down. So having to have a little rethink about how we do things. We had a day with five back-to-back meetings where everyone said yes. Big brands, and it was amazing. And then 2 days later, they all rang back and said, ah, we've got our budgets locked down and the world has just changed completely. Let's get back to you on that. So now we're figuring out different ways to get our product out there. And if we can sell it in this environment, well, then we're on a winner and we're getting some really cool people taking it up. Hopefully, awards, because awards are massively important, because a new product is great and shiny and everyone wants to try it, but you've got no belief, you've got no faith or trust in it when you're an outside person wanting to buy it, whereas an existing product is boring and it's like, do I really want to buy that? But you've got the trust and the belief. So awards give us that inherent trust that people can just pick it up and go for. So that's really important for us. Some really good case studies are going to help brilliantly. And from there, hopefully, keep making this product better and better and better until we see where it can go.
Do you see there's a lot of competition in the market at the moment for what you're doing? Or are you coming up with this whole idea of having a product that can create this serious e-learning game-based environment? Is that a relatively new thing?
No, there's some awesome things that are out there. So there's a quiz called Kahoot that you can play very simply, set your little quizzes up, share them as a team. We do something slightly different. We try and encourage you to play at different times as opposed to together. And but anyone who's used Kahoot and it's worked for them, I can guarantee our product would as well. And lots of our clients use both now because they don't want to use, but need differentiation. So it's going to grow all the time. And as we all, e-learning is one of those things that is going to be a big boom, I'd have thought, in the very near future, because certainly as we all, I'm working from home. I'm loving it. I thought I'd hate it. Maybe we'll meet up in coffee shops and just have a little chat about what we might do that week. So you get that face-to-face and then go back home. So distributed learning, distributed content is just going to become more and more important, I think.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. And it's really interesting to see you talking about this, because it sounds a lot like how you started out as well. And it feels in the same way that you've identified a new opportunity. It's fairly immature in terms of the marketplace, and you've spotted that and you're just pushing forward to try and do something with it, which I think is just really interesting and quite inspirational in terms of how you want to try and think about what you're doing. Is not just plow the furrow that other people are doing or other people have done, but to try and understand what is new, where the potential is, and to try and develop that. And it's going to be a simpler win because there are just fewer people who you're going to compete with.
Yes, the irony is I'm absolutely rubbish at selling the same thing. So if you came up to me and say, Mike, I want to buy an apple from you, I couldn't sell you an apple. I would be absolutely rubbish at it. So you put a pitch out and you say, people, I want to buy apples. And you put it out to five people. Four of them are going to come up and give you a sales pitch about on why their apples are better than the other person's. So you're there, one in five chance. So maybe they've got something. I'm going to come up to you and say, stuff apples, they're boring. What about this banana? So now their choice is one of the people selling apples or this person selling you banana. So I've made it 2-1, I think. So that's how we used to win our clients. We couldn't pitch the idea that they gave us. We would always disrupt and say, nah, we think you're doing it wrong. What about if you did it this way? So yeah, I naturally look for those opportunities because that's the kind of person I am. And if someone knows they want something very specific, I simply send a different person to go and talk to them because it's not me.
Fantastic. Well, look, disruption is always a good place to wrap things up with. So let's leave it there. Thank you so much for putting up with the tractors, the vans, the birdsong, your family, and no neighbours, which is, I was hoping to meet a couple. But
let's not leave it on I've put up with my family. Let's leave it on my family have blessed me with their presence because they are awesome.
Well, it's very kind that they came along to give you an audience and cheer you along in this.
Indeed. So I hope this audio wasn't too birdsong and tractory and difficult to listen to. And thank you very much, everyone who's listening. And Anthony, I really enjoyed listening to your podcast. So thank you very much.
Thank you. That's very kind of you. Thanks, Mike.
Have a lovely day. Goodbye.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. There's more information about all of our guests and all the topics they talk about at 10thdegree.co.uk. And also, please do review us. We really want to share the lessons and the advice that's given as widely as possible, and this really helps us to get that message out there. Thanks.